This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock now on this Wednesday, January the 17th. I'm Joy Cardine. Are you anxious, depressed, or distressed? How can you best improve your emotional health? Our guest this hour is an integrative psychiatrist. And she says you don't have to choose between mainstream medicine or alternative therapies. She says even when a medication is necessary to treat a diagnosed mental health ailment, it's often only part of the healing puzzle. She says successful treatment most often lies in bringing together your medical care, complementary and alternative approaches, and spiritual practices. We'll talk about the mind-body-spirit approach in taking charge of our emotional lives this hour. 1-800-642-1234. And we welcome your questions for our guest. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Our guest is Dr. Eve Wood, a psychiatrist and clinical associate professor of medicine at the University of Arizona Program on Integrative Medicine. Dr. Wood is host of a weekly internet radio show called Healing Your Body, Mind, Spirit. She is author, most recently, of 10 Steps to Take Charge of Your Emotional Life, Overcoming Anxiety, Distress, and Depression Through Whole Person Healing. And she joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be with you this morning.
Yeah, thanks a lot for joining us. I hardly know where to start. There's so much in here, but let me start with what you're hoping to accomplish with the book. What do you hope it does?
Well, you know, that's a fabulous question, Joy, because really I'm a medical doctor, of course, with many, many years of clinical experience and training. But what I found is that the traditional offerings in just medicine are inadequate and not enough to help most people heal. So what my mission and passion is all about is to empower people in how to put together what we understand in traditional medicine with lots of other things that can make a difference. Because at the end of the day, each one of us is ultimately responsible for our health and wellness. And if we know how to approach it and how to work with the people that can help us, different doctors and healers, and what we can do with our own mind, body, and spiritual strategies, then we can be truly well.
What's considered our emotional life? What are some of the emotional ailments we might be suffering from?
Well, you know, the ones that I focus on in this particular book are the many of the common anxiety problems that people have, like panic problems, obsessive-compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress, generalized anxiety, all of the common depression problems like major depression, low-level dysthymic depression, manic depressive or bipolar illness, seasonal affective disorder, and so on. And it also deals with attention deficit disorder. And then it also deals with just the general challenges of stress that we experience in life and the down days and the ways we hang ourselves up. So the first steps in the book are the steps to help you with some quizzes and checklists and so on, assess whether or not you have a clinical condition of some kind that may need a medical intervention. Mm. So in a very quick way, it kind of puts you in charge of your health and gives you an idea of what you might need to talk to a doctor about or get evaluated for. And then if none of that fits, then you move on to the other steps and you don't need to do anything in the medical realm.
Yeah, so how do you determine if medication may be needed or not?
Well, you know, it's a great thing to think about because we have such a huge abundance of prescriptions, you know, in our world. And the medicines for things like depression are among the most prescribed in the world, and it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. And there are absolutely people who are taking medication that probably shouldn't be and some who probably need it that aren't. So I say, and I describe this in the book very specifically, that it only makes sense to take a medicine if you have a clear condition that has shown to benefit from medicine.
Yeah.
And Second, that your symptoms are significant enough that the potential side effects, because every single medicine, even Tylenol that we take over the counter, has side effects, the potential benefits outweigh the side effects.
Yeah, and you also you go through a number of case studies right off in the top of the book where you might be given a medication to treat a disorder that's a misdiagnosis.
Right. I mean, one of the things that's troubled me greatly for over 20 years of clinical practice is that I would see many, many, many people who'd been in care for a long time and feel very discouraged because they weren't getting anywhere, and they'd come to see me like, oh, doc, maybe you can help me kind of thing. And when we went in the very first visit through some of these common checklists, which are based only on your story and your symptoms, it was very clear that the diagnosis they had been given and therefore the medicine was wrong. So the first step of what might be necessary to then work maybe on some other issues about their life choices or, you know, nutrition or something else was wrong. So it's like trying to build a building on a shaky foundation, and the other stuff doesn't stick.
Yeah, but even if someone has your book, you still need to go to a doctor to get any sort of a prescription. So, I mean, you do have to consult a traditional doctor probably, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, surely if you have an anxiety problem or a depression problem and so on, and it looks like you might have some clinical condition, even the thyroid condition that could affect this. So the book is not meant to replace in any way, shape, or form the kinds of treatment providers and healers and supports that we may well all need in some capacity. What it's absolutely meant to do is help you know what you might want to go to be asking about, how to discuss certain things with your doctor, how to there's a whole section on how do medicines work and what to expect and what you need to know and what you should ask. There are a lot of tables in the book, 10 Steps to Take Charge of Your Emotional Life, on, you know, how, where you can document, you know, what your symptoms are, how severe they are, what the side effects are, how severe they are over time, and then bring these tables in even to your doctor so in a very short time, because usually that's all we have in our appointments, mm-hmm. you know, you can begin to convey where you are and how you're doing so that you can get the best care. Because obviously, if we don't convey to our care providers what's going on with us and what we need and what we're struggling with, they can't respond. And a lot of the time, even with the best intentions, they're not given enough time to ask us.
Yeah. And you say here, even when medication might be necessary, it's only part of the healing puzzle.
Yes.
You're saying we'll be better off, we'll better improve our emotional health if we incorporate these alternative or complementary approaches.
Exactly. Because, you know, of course, most people are prescribed the medications by their primary care doctors. And oftentimes the medication, assuming people are told how to use it and, you know, someone's working with them over time on how to adjust dose and side effects and how to make a change if it's not the right one, can help get you out of a big hole sometimes or out of a stuck place to another place. But it's inadequate because we're whole people and only one part is this imbalance. So there are many other things we can do to affect it. And some of the, you know, common complementary alternative interventions that I love are things that are very simple to do, like exercise, for example, is a great one. About 30 minutes of aerobic exercise, which means not you have to take an aerobics class, but, you know, get your heart rate mm-hmm. up and so on, has been found to be a very powerful antidepressant by itself, actually, even in moderate depression, has a significant diminishment for anxiety and also helps people with attentional problems concentrate better. So that's an example. Mind-body tools like meditation-guided imagery and yoga have been found in a number of studies now to significantly affect mood and concentration and level of anxiety. There were some nutritional and herbal interventions that can make a big difference. And one of the most common, and we're hearing about this a lot because it has many, many health benefits, is the role of course, fish oil, mm-hmm. you know, which actually, even in some studies, has now been shown by itself to be a powerful antidepressant. And it's because the omega-3 fatty acids, you know, that's the fatty acids that are in the fish oil, are actually necessary for almost every cell in our body to function. And as it turns out, many of us are depleted in it because our food sources have shifted so much over the generations. So it used to be that when, you know, so many animals and so forth were grass-fed, because that's where a lot of these natural oils were, that we would get a lot of the oils in our diet and we wouldn't need to supplement. But at this point, a lot of people don't have enough. And so they're more vulnerable to a lot of cardiac issues, for example, and other things, as well as mood problems.
What about the spiritual piece? Do you have to be a religious person to have a good mental or emotional health?
No, and that's a great question because, you know, we often think about the difference between religion or a faith-based practice and other spiritual practices. And no, it doesn't have to be faith-based. And in fact, many, many people will say that they're spiritual but not religious, you know, that they don't particularly attach their sense of meaning, hope, making a difference in the world, their values, and so forth to a God figure. So, but, of course, through many religions, you will find a lot of those same values. And I personally think that the spiritual practices and so on are so beneficial because they affect, in a sense, two aspects of function, you know. In all the spiritual traditions, there's a philosophy that affects our cognitive brain. And the philosophy is often about, you know, personal value and ethics and so on. And that is uplifting. And then there are often practices, whether they're meditative or prayer or singing or chanting, and that affects the emotional brain. And actually, it's interesting because most medicines affect more that emotional brain, and most cognitive therapy interventions and talk therapy and self-help affect the cognitive brain. So a lot of the spiritual practices probably are very beneficial because they affect both.
We are talking with the author of the book, 10 Steps to Take Charge of Your Emotional Life. She is Dr. Eve Wood. 1-800-642-1234 is our toll-free number if you'd like to ask her a question. She's a psychiatrist and author of a number of books. This is her latest. She can help us with some of these alternative therapies that help people heal, such as music, yoga, massage therapy, light therapy, talking about integrating complementary and alternative approaches with traditional medicine. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Ben Marins is with you this afternoon between 4 and 6 for At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5, Ben talks with Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, presidential candidate for the Republican Party. He's also the author of From Hope to Higher Ground, 12 Stops to Restoring America's Greatness. So, a presidential candidate on with Ben Marins at Issue with Ben after 5. We're talking with a psychiatrist, Eve Wood. She is the author of 10 Steps to Take Charge of Your Emotional Life. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Subtitle, Overcoming Anxiety, Distress, and Depression Through Whole Person Healing. Saying we should combine mainstream medicine with alternative therapies, kind of a mind-body-spirit combination. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We have one open line for you, but before we go to the phones, Dr. Wood,
sure.
I wanted to talk a little bit, now I'm having trouble finding the case study in the book. It was a woman who was in her 50s who was presenting with, I think, some physical ailments, stomach pains or something.
Uh-huh.
She wasn't a religious person, and it was how you dealt with that particular case. Do you remember that one?
Well, let me think.
She wasn't a religious person, but she was different ways that she could.
Yes. Well, I may not be saying exactly the one you're thinking of, but one of the things that I often experience is that people. Well, you're actually speaking to two different things, and I'm not sure, but But one of the things you're speaking to, which there's a chapter about in the book, which is learn the language of your body and make friends with your inner healer, and that there are a lot of examples there where, which are of people who have physical manifestations like stomach problems or neurologic symptoms or so on that ultimately turn out to be the result of an anxiety problem or something else that we're able to identify. And by doing that, you know, help them take charge. But I've worked with a number of people, and this may be the person you're thinking of, but I think she might have had some gynecologic issues, but I'm not sure, who basically came in, and she had a series of different symptoms, physical symptoms, that but she wasn't religious or spiritual in any way. But one of the things that she shared from the very beginning of her time with me is that she didn't know what she ought to be doing with her life. And as we began to work on her anxiety problem and so on in some very specific strategies, which significantly helped her be less anxious and the physical symptoms began to go away, she started to incorporate a lot more what I would think of as spiritual-type practices in her life. Some of these meditation practices, she started volunteering in the local soup kitchen. She started to do a lot of things that were about connection and giving back and making a difference in the world. And as she began to do those things progressively, she began to feel better and better and symptom-free. And I saw there being a connection, even though she didn't call them spiritual, and towards the end of our time, you know, I told her I was writing this book, you know, about you know, integrative healing and the spiritual dimension. She said, "Well, I'm not spiritual at all." And I said to her, "Well, that's interesting you say that, because when we first started working together, you know, you said you don't know what you're meant to be doing with your life, and to me, that's a, in a certain sense, a spiritual question. It begs the notion that you know, there's some purpose that we have here, there's something we're supposed to do, and now." You're doing all of these things in your life that are about giving back and making bigger connection and so on, and you feel well.
Yeah,
so,
and that was the case.
It
She was also a woman who she didn't have children, and I remember that she she ended up I think adopting a you know a child you know through one of those charity organizations.
Exactly, mm-hmm. because you know she started out with a lot of gynecologic mm-hmm. symptoms. Yeah, mm-hmm. And one of the things we talked about is she had gone through many years of infertility intervention and so on, and never conceived, and now she was past the point in her life where it was reasonable to. Do that. She didn't, of course, want to keep doing it anyway, and she was old enough that you know, literally adopting a child that would come into her home was not very practical. But she researched these various organizations where you can literally support a child, adopt, take on the care of that child financially, and then you get updates and so on. And that made a huge difference too.
But the you know, volunteering and this sort of good work is a way to nurture your spirit.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. By giving back, we get more.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Mary Lou, is it in Cudahy? Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, Mary Lou.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Mary Lou.
Hi. I have been a mental health consumer for the past 19 years.
Okay, you're not alone.
No, major depression and a few other things.
Okay.
My question and comment is, excuse me, I lose my focus.
That's okay.
In looking for a new psychiatrist, I found that several, in fact, don't even want to see people with severe mental illness. They only want to see people like every 5 to 6 months just to manage their medications. They don't want anybody with severe mental illness. I've seen this change over the years to my newer psychiatrists where they basically don't take the time to ask about your life.
Right.
You know, social, emotional, spiritual.
Right.
You know, now you just go in, it takes 2 or 3 minutes, they do your meds, and goodbye.
That's right.
And I've had a very hard time hooking up with a psychiatrist who will, you know, look at the rest of my life and how that affects my mental illness.
Uh-huh.
And that's important, isn't it, Dr.
Yeah.
Wood?
Oh, I'm really glad that you called to talk about that, because one of My biggest concerns, and part of the reason I write the books I do and do all the teaching and talking that I do, and I teach doctors around the world too, and other mental health professionals as well as, you know, individuals looking to heal, is because of my concern about exactly what you're sharing. You know, in the years that I've been in clinical practice, from the time I trained, you know, and seeing patients, our healthcare system has become more and more, in my opinion, broken. I mean, we've become more sophisticated in certain ways, but a lot of the way things used to be done, where there was more time and people did do, you know, maybe partly also because we didn't have so many medicines, you know, the traditional psychiatrist spent a lot of time talking and listening to patients, and maybe there were some medicines that were included, but that was not the primary aspect of care that went on there. And actually, I remember pretty vividly as it began to change, where it started when I was in the Philadelphia area, and there were patients. I had some patients in the hospital, and this managed care began. You know, where now there was this third party in between the insurance and the patient and the doctor that would call up and try to get you to justify every day that the patient was in the hospital. And someone was admitted to the hospital I was taking care of, you know, with a major depression, had been suicidal, of course, needed to be in the hospital. And they wanted the person out in 3 days. Mm-hmm. And nobody gets better in 3 days, you know. And, of course, everyone had insurance at that time, pretty much, that allowed them 30 days of care in a hospital. And it started to happen that you had to justify every extra day. And, of course, as you know well, obviously you've lived with depression for many years, it's a long-term thing, and you may have a good day and then some real bad ones, and climbing out of the hole can take a while. So, and the model now, to a large extent, in many communities, because of our shift in training as a result of shift in payment, is exactly what you're describing, that people will see the psychiatrist for some sort of assessment, hopefully, and then maybe periodic what are called medicine checkups, you know, that are very brief. And there's some expectation that if you need something else, you go somewhere else for that. And that's what a lot of people are dealing with. So one of the reasons that I've been sharing and writing as I have is that the more each one of us as patients, because, of course, we're all patients in the world, too, understands kind of all the pieces and so on, the more at least we can begin to put together maybe a treatment team and some things that we also do that can help us. Because it doesn't seem like for most of us there's anybody there sort of being that guide, mentor, and consistent support. It's really a terrible problem.
Yeah. Do you have any general advice? Certainly Mary Lou isn't going to be able to see you since you're in Arizona.
No.
But to Mary Lou or anybody looking for a doctor or a psychiatrist like yourself, who an integrative psychiatrist.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the things that I talk about in 10 steps to take charge of your emotional life are things that you can do whether with or without the doctor. In other words, they don't require the doctor. What I think it's important for people to first look for is somebody who is open to the other things that you might do. Because the reality is most people are not necessarily going to be knowledgeable about all of them, but there are going to be people who are more open-minded. They're the ones that want to learn themselves, you know, how to put this stuff together. And surely you can ask that. I mean, you can ask the doctor, you know, how much experience do you have treating depression? You know, what do you use? You know, do you recommend or support people to do things in addition, therapies and self-care stuff in addition to medication and so on? And you can begin to get an idea of at least how open-minded and supportive the care provider would be.
Good luck to you, Mary Lou. Fred in Watertown is with us. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Fred.
I experienced a severe nervous breakdown in 1970. I did shock treatments, talk sessions, Tafranil, Melaril, Thorazine, Valium.
Wow.
After about 3 years of that, I quit it all. I said, it isn't helping. I feel rotten with it. I feel rotten without it, but at least I'm not groggy. I was severely depressed every day, but I went back to school, got an engineering degree. In 1978, I walked into a health food store and picked up a book entitled Sugar Blues.
Went on good a for you, hypoglycemic diet.
Yeah. No sugar, no white flour, no caffeine, no alcohol, nothing sweet. In the advertised 2.5 months, I was better. I've been on the diet for almost 30 years now. I know what I can eat and what I can't. If I cheat on something like chocolates or coffee, I'll experience 2 days of nervous depression. Okay, fine. Been there, done that. Back on the wagon, and I'm better again in a couple of days.
Well, that's really interesting, because what you're describing is, you know, you had a breakdown of a certain point, and a lot of us can go through a time like that once in our lives. And it may well be that some of the interventions that you got at that time briefly were the right ones, but some of the things that you were taking then, you know, the medicines that you've mentioned, have some very powerful side effects, and some people don't tolerate them very well at all. And you know, one of the questions I address in the book is, how long do you take a medicine? And if it's the first time of having a condition, there's not a good reason necessarily to think that it's something you need to do indefinitely. Second, one of the things also you're bringing up, which is very important, is that a lot of people, especially with anxiousness, are very sensitive to sugar and caffeine. And they can have really significant symptoms from the use of that stuff. And, of course, we don't tend to think about it a lot, but chocolate, you know, the cocoa, has a fair amount of caffeine in it. Not as much as a strong cup of coffee, but for people who are very sensitive to it, it's an important thing to be mindful of. And actually, in a growing way, this is of a concern, because a lot of these, quote, health drinks and many other medicines that people take have added caffeine. So it's really important to look at labels if you are at all sensitive to that, because in a growing way, it's added to many things.
Yeah. Thanks, Fred, for calling, and I'm glad you're doing much better, it sounds.
Yeah.
Rochelle in Port Washington is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Rochelle.
I took a Reiki 1 class this last weekend, and I was hoping to use it to get off antidepressants that I'm on, two different prescriptions. And you have to go through your 21-day clearing and meditate with the chakras and the colors and stuff, and I'm having trouble visualizing any colors or anything, so I don't know if that just takes time or if it's not for me.
I'm sorry, because you're on the medication, you think you can't see the colors of the chakra?
No, I don't think it's...
I think you were saying that you want to get off them and you're not able to use these techniques. This is the beginning, is this is what you have to do in the practice, I think.
That's right.
But let me ask you a question first, my dear. You're on what medicines?
On Lexapro and Wellbutrin.
Okay, so two antidepressants. And how long have you been depressed? When was your first episode, and have you had more than one?
I think it started out as, like, postpartum.
Okay.
That never went away.
Okay. And how long ago was that?
Probably about 4 years ago.
Okay. So let me just give you some feedback. I mean, first of all, we don't have any evidence at this point. Not that it can't happen. I don't want to mislead you there. But we don't have any evidence at this point that the Reiki practice in and of itself can replace the need for medicine. Now, it may for some people, but we don't know that. So the way it works with clinical depression is that the longer a person has been depressed or the more episodes they have, the more likely they are to need some medicine. Just because the long-term studies of depression, looking at it over the life cycle, have found that for a substantial number of people, it's a chronic or recurrent illness. Mm-hmm. So I would not suggest that you approach the Reiki or anything else that you start doing as necessarily something that immediately you're going to think of as a replacement. But right. I would suggest you think about it as something that, you know, is complementary at first, that you're adding to see if it can make a difference. And then under the supervision of a doctor, whoever it is that prescribes your medicine, you know, if you start feeling like, you know, there's some interventions you're doing that maybe are making some more difference, maybe in a in a controlled way, you can see if you can begin to reduce the medicine. But again, under a doctor's care. But I don't want you to go into it thinking, well, if I just get this down in a certain number of days, I should stop my medicine, especially since you mentioned it's postpartum. I hear some children in the background, and heaven forbid, you know, you get to a place where you're unable to, you know, take care of yourself or your kids.
Right.
Rochelle, thank you very much for the call. We're going to take a short pause and then welcome more calls for our guest, Eve Wood. She is an integrative psychiatrist. Eve Wood, MD, author of 10 Steps to Take Charge of Your Emotional Life, Overcoming Anxiety, Distress, and Depression Through Whole Person Healing. Eve Wood, Dr. Wood, is a psychiatrist and clinical associate professor of medicine at the University of Arizona Program on Integrative Medicine. She's also the host of a weekly internet radio call-in show, Healing Your Body, Mind, and Spirit. 1-800-642-1234, our toll-free number if you have a question for her. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock in view of the pending takeover of Midwest Airlines. Kathleen's guest after 9 will examine some recent consolidations in the airline industry, and they'll talk about the state of the airline industry coming up after 9 o'clock. Talking about controlling, improving your emotional health with an integrative approach, body, mind, spirit approach, where you can have traditional medicine combined with alternative or complementary approaches, as well as some spiritual approaches. Our next caller is Raquel in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Raquel, you're on the air.
Hi, hi, Dr. Wood.
Hi, Raquel.
Hi, I am actually calling you. I'm on my way from Chicago to central Wisconsin to see my mother. My mother is who I'm calling about. She has been clinically depressed. Actually, I think she's been diagnosed bipolar.
That's a big difference, and we'll talk about that, but go ahead.
With anxiety disorder on top of it.
Wow, okay.
And she's been, from what I can assess from her, from the history that she's told me, she's probably been dealing with this since her teenage years, and it's just gotten worse over the course of her life. She's had a lot of life events that have contributed, I believe, to the depression and anxiety, and we have a strong family history of anxiety and depression.
Okay.
And I am actually on my way to meet with my brother to try to decide what we can do to help her. She's really, really in a rut right now. I have a 17-year-old brother at home still. She has quit her job, so she has no income.
Wow.
She has been on probably every medicine known to man, and I don't even know what she's on right now. I'm a nurse, and I'll check when I get there to see what she's taking.
Okay.
But basically my question is when I get there and I talk to my brother, I would love to have some professional advice on what steps we should take to help her, because I really think that she's not coming out of this on her own. And at this point, she refuses to even listen to anything we have to say about, you know, do you think that you need some help? Can we take you to a doctor? Can we have somebody look at you? And she's been physically sick now for about a month. And I think that a lot of it is the mental illness that's contributing to her physical symptoms.
Yeah, well, often it is, you know, and of course she may be having some side effects too that are making her feel ill, depending what medicine she's taking. It could be a combination. But let me ask you this. How long has it been that she's been diagnosed manic depressive or bipolar?
I would probably say a good 20 years.
For 20 years. And does she have then a regular psychiatrist that she sees? Because most people with manic depressive illness, since it's a cyclical illness, need somebody over time to see, evaluate, and adjust medicines. Does she do that?
I know that she has had psychiatrists and psychologists that she has seen previously. I do not think that she is seeing anybody right now. Basically, her consensus is, you know, nobody helps me. I can't get a medicine that helps me. You know, I take a medicine for 2 weeks and I can't stand the side effects.
And where does she live?
She lives in, she lives close to La Crosse. She lives in a small town close to La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Uh-huh. And has she ever been hospitalized or been in a...
She has. I remember when I was a little girl, actually, she was hospitalized. I think I was very young, but I do believe it was from a suicide attempt.
Okay. Well, see, with manic depressive illness or bipolar illness, as you know, probably, and I don't know how many listeners know, but, you know, it's a cyclical illness, and there are periods of severe depression and periods of hypomania or mania, which is a psychotic type of an illness. And some people cycle rapidly from one to the other or have frequent episodes, and some people don't. Most people stay in depression more of the time than not. And, of course, you can have other problems as well. Many people have other problems, like an anxiety disorder. It sounds like your mom might have. And, of course, this is all very heavily genetically transmitted, and you did mention, you know, it runs, some of this runs in your family. With bipolar illness in particular, there's a much higher risk of suicide than with other clinical depression in general. And it's interesting that, you know, that's probably what led your mom to a hospitalization. Probably the most beneficial thing that you can do is actually get her to get a full evaluation with somebody who has some expertise in that community in treating manic depressive illness, because they would really need to look at the sort of what she's taken over time and what her symptoms have been. I mean, there are people who particularly have some expertise in that illness, because she may very well not be on the right combination of medicines for where she is right now, because, see, it's not stable.
Yeah,
and it changes.
It's so hard for Raquel, she says, though, because I guess her mother's just refusing or not, you know, not listening. So, is there any way a family member can coax somebody who needs to seek some help to seek some help?
Well, you know, of course, we can't force it unless the person is of danger to themselves or someone else. Now, if she's so unable to provide for her child, that might qualify. You'll have to see when you get there. But oftentimes, we can if we're going along, we can get the person to go. And sometimes what we can do, actually, and maybe the first step, is for you and your brother to, you know, get enough of the history and then meet with somebody and get some ideas of strategies that they might use to get your mom in. A lot of times I'll work with people to do that.
Yeah, because my concern at this point is when we go to her with this, you know, she's going to refuse.
Right.
She's going to basically refuse treatment. She's pretty much refusing to even discuss any of this with us. Mm. She's belligerent, basically, when we try to talk to her about it.
Okay. So then what might be what you need to do is assess the situation and then get the kind of guidance within the community of, you know, obviously there's a minor there, you know, your sibling, I guess.
Yeah.
So what is to be done there? Sometimes that's an adequate leverage, actually, to get somebody into treatment.
Good luck to you, Raquel. Thank you for calling. Daniel in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm diagnosed bipolar, and I'm a functioning person with mental illness. I'm in the trades, but I was over medicated all my life,
right?
And I was a zombie in the Thorazine shuffle. I decided I'm not taking all this medication. I'm going to take part of it because I want my mania. I want that some of that. I want that energy, and it gives me an edge. And I, instead of going out there and getting my butt whooped by other people because I can't, you know, compete with them, you know, mentally and emotionally, and you know how it is, how that works. It actually works for me.
You know, you're raising something very important, and that is everything is a question of frequency and degree. So I think I mentioned that there are these checklists about, you know, what are the symptoms, what am I helped with, and what am I harmed with in terms of side effects in the 10 Steps book. And you're speaking to something important, which is that you might need some medicine to help you be functional, but if you take too much of that medicine, it makes you non-functional. And a lot of people with manic depressive illness, when they're very slightly hypomanic, they're energized in a productive way, and then if it's a little too much, it becomes unproductive. And it's really a process of finding exactly the right balance of what's good enough and doesn't cause too much trouble. So good for you. It sounds like, at least for now, you found the right solution.
Thank you, Daniel. The book is 10 Steps to Take Charge of Your Emotional Life. The author is Dr. Eve Wood. The book helps us figure out the best way to achieve emotional well-being, be it medication or therapy or some sort of alternative or complementary treatment like herbal supplements or nutrition, exercise. 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. How about nurturing our spirits? Alex in Wauwatosa. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Joy, and hello, guest.
Hi, Alex.
Hi, the doctor makes a lot of sense.
Thank you.
The woman driving to La Crosse.
Yes.
That's a particularly difficult story. In Wisconsin, it is very, very difficult to get an adult into mental health treatment of any kind unless one is willing to apply some pretty heavy coercion.
Yeah, it's in a lot of states. Yeah.
Yeah, in terms of getting the county, the corporation council involved, a three-party petition is possible, but boy, is that coercive.
Yeah, so that's why I say sometimes if you have the issue of a child, you can use that as leverage, you know, that you're not able to care for the child, and sometimes people will do it.
Yeah, maybe the mother might actually do something if it's put to her that way. Maybe.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. But if I'm not that woman driving to the cross. But if I were, I would, if I was worried, I would consider the possibility of perhaps getting tough.
Exactly. Sometimes that's what we have to do, right?
Yeah.
It's like that tough love thing. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's not what I called about.
Okay.
I did want to make a comment that you know, in my view, that psychiatrists are supposed to be the experts in relationships.
Uh-huh.
And it does seem to be important for the doctor to be with the patient, to attend the patient, the attending physician.
Exactly.
And to listen to the patient, to the family, and to understand what is going on with the patient internally.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is no one will pay for listening to the patient. If there's one complaint that patients and family have, it's the doctor doesn't spend time with me. The doctor doesn't listen to me.
Exactly.
The doctor doesn't hear me. But on the other hand, Medicaid pays pennies on the dollar. Managed care companies negotiate greatly discounted rates, and bean counters are watching. And there's a big emphasis on production. See patients, generate billing documents, on to the next. And this, I find this whole system in medical economics very, very disturbing. And unless a patient is willing to pay out of pocket, or perhaps a psychiatrist is subsidized in some way, got an NIH grant or whatever, then it's almost an impossible situation. I'll listen off the air. Thanks very much for the program.
Okay, thanks for your comments. I think it's really important. I mean, you're right that our system is broken, and we're not adequately valuing what's probably most valuable. You know, there's a step in the book about the importance of building connection for health, and we have many, many studies now that show that having connection, being cared for by one another, and sharing our stories is deeply healing and preventive of many health conditions, of course, anxiety, depression, but cancer and other things. And, of course, our healthcare model doesn't even allow that to happen oftentimes between provider and patient. So it's really a serious problem, and it's the economics of medicine as opposed to the practice and the art of medicine.
Thank you, Alex. Robert in Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Robert.
I've been suffering from depression, severe depression, since about 1985.
It's a long time.
And I've been through ups and downs, and I've had all the different treatments. And I've been on different medications, and I've had shock treatments, and I've been hospitalized at times. And the thing that seemed to work the best for me was when I undertook to take a real look at human beings and seeing what kind of animals we really are.
Good for you.
And discovering, you know, how much we, of the stuff that we, is a big concern to us and things like that, is just stuff we've made up in our own minds and in our culture and in our society, and that they really are something that we do because we're not that great an animal. And if you get that perspective, pretty soon I think, you know, things begin to fall into a simpler line. It doesn't stop people. Doesn't stop the way way we live and the culture that we have, but it allows you to understand that so much stuff that you think are problems and so on are just baloney.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because one of the steps, and it's a really powerful one in this book, is identify the beliefs that imprison you and reprogram the brain circuits involved. And you're really speaking to something very important, which is the degree to which our thoughts and our outlook and our way of viewing things can have a very powerful effect on our vulnerability to anxiety, depression, and immune-related disorders. And it's something we all have amazing power to change. And I teach people specifically how to do that in 10 steps. But, you know, it's not medicine. You know, you've shared that you were on many medicines and have been for a lot of years, but here's something that you've learned kind of how to do, kind of working with yourself and how much difference it makes. And that's very wonderful.
Thank you, Robert. Jan in Marshfield. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Jan.
Hi. I have a couple of comments here. First of all, I believe that people really have a basic need to belong.
Absolutely, you're right.
And I believe that sometimes the labeling, although I know in the medical profession, you need to have a way to quantify things, behaviors, but the labeling itself becomes counterproductive and separates people even further from society. And so, and the second part of this is that do you see any like self-help groups for depressed people that if they're not addicts, can they get involved in self-help? Because one way to raise self-esteem is to learn that we all have certain answers in ourselves, and we only have a very an easier way of doing that in a group where we feel more comfortable.
Well, Jen, you're raising great stuff. First of all, I specifically address that issue of labels. I think the naming of something, the labeling of it, is only important in as much as if we don't do that for clinical research, we don't know what medicines and what interventions can make a difference. We don't know if we're all looking at the same thing. So it's only important to name it if it helps us figure out something that might help. Beyond that, I don't think it's useful at all. So so that's the first point, and that's a very important one. Second of all, you're very right that there's a tremendous amount that we can do with ourselves that can make a huge difference, and a lot of it's about connection and life choices that we make and lifestyle issues and so on. And I teach people a lot about how to do that in 10 steps. There are, in some communities, And honestly, many of the tools and the things that I share, there are things that I do that every one of us ought to be doing in some ways in our lives, whether or not we suffer from a depression or an anxiety disorder. Most of the people that I see over time, eventually they start talking to their friends and stuff about some of these other things that they're doing because they're so reasonable and common, and most people are open to them in life. There are some self-help groups in some communities that are kind of like 12-step. That are about personal empowerment. But you'd have to look in your community because they're not across the board.
And we'll have to leave it there. Dr. Wood, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Eve Wood, author of 10 Steps to Take Charge of Your Emotional Life. Thanks to Karen Prager and Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.